All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome again to the Read Rothbard podcast. We're back. We're back again. We're back at it. We got cut short in our previous episode because wife unit Zappa arrived home with sleeping kids and needed my help. So we were talking about in time, and I ran out of time. And so Robert is back with me. How are you doing, Robert?
I'm great. Is this a whole other episode, or is this like a going to be slammed into the last episode somewhere awkwardly? Kind of cram it in there, nestle it in between.
Did you just sexually harass me?
My name is Humongous.
I figure that we have enough content in the previous episode, and we have enough to talk about in this one, that I think it shall be distinct.
Okay. This is its own thing, even though we don't know what we're doing. How is that any different than any other time? It's fine.
So that'll make this episode 18. I've already got art built out for both of these episodes. They're going to be fairly similar, and they're sort of based on a little ditty. It was on the Saturday Night Live not too far, a few years ago. A little song by Justin Timberlake when he was a host. So I'll just throw that in. Writes about here.
Hey, girl, I got something real important to give you. So just sit down and listen.
Girl, you know we've been together such a long, long time.
Such a long time.
And now I'm ready to lay it on the line.
Wow, you know it's Christmas and my heart is open wide.
Open wide.
Gonna give you something so you know what's on my mind.
What's on my mind? A gift real special, so take off the top.
Take a look inside. It's my dick in a box.
It's in a box.
Not gonna get you a diamond ring. That sort of gift don't mean anything. Not gonna get you a fancy car. Girl, you gotta know you're my shining star. Not gonna get you a house in the hills. A girl like you needs something real. Wanna get you something from the heart.
Something special, girl.
It's my dick in a box. My dick in a box, babe. It's my dick in a box. Ooh, my dick in a box, girl. See, I'm wise enough to know when a gift needs giving. And I got just the one. Something to show you that you are second to none.
Fellas out there with ladies to impress, it's easy to do, just follow these steps. 1.
Cut a hole in a box.
2.
Put your junk in that box.
3.
Make her open the box, and that's the way you do it. It's my dick in a box. My dick in a box, babe. It's my dick in a box. Ooh, my dick in a box, girl.
Christmas.
Dig in a box.
Hanukkah.
Dig in a box.
Kwanzaa.
A dig in a box. Every single holiday, dig in a box. Over at your parents' house, a dig in a box. Midday at the grocery store, a dig in a box. Backstage at the CMAs, a dig in a box. Yeah, well. My dig in a box. My dig in a box.
Oh yeah,
Lonely Island, JT.
That's right, probably the highlight of his highlight of his whole career, man, right there.
Yeah, that's probably the highlight of his career for me. Although he didn't like write the song or anything, but nevertheless.
good enough, and I can't believe we did a whole show yesterday where we didn't even mention the Dick in the Box, and it's, you know, Timberlake, and he's not a good actor.
Because we were on point talking about the movie, Daniel.
That's true. We were. We were. I've listened to the recording, and it's actually pretty good. I think that we did a very fine job of dissecting the movie, first half, because I did not had not yet seen the second half of the film in the past 5 years. But I rectified that last night, watched it
yeah, you were
in bed.
Texting me like way late into the night when you're you normally a early sleeper. What were your new insights after seeing the whole movie?
Well, it just gets worse. I will say that. The whole production method of the time and the why they're stored and where they come from is never explained. Of course, the Peter Keating guy.
It's safe to say that this is a completely fiat currency. So all you have to do is change a few ones and zeros, and everybody could live forever if they wanted to, but it's just the idea that there's too many people, so you have to kill off a bunch. Is that basically
the idea? I don't know if that means that somehow the time that is owed to the people is being taken from them, like the surplus value, if you will, if you're a Marxist. It doesn't make any sense, really. So the Peter Keating guy, Philip Weiss, he's this banker dude, and he's the main villain. And they make it seem as if he's hoarding this, you know, million years of time in this big bank vault and has a bunch of branch banks elsewhere where people are getting loans at high interest rates, like 30%, something like that. And the cost of living keeps going up, and taxes keep going up, and that's an effort to, you know, control the population, Malthusian thing.
So these rich people haven't actually created any wealth by actually making anything. They've just invented this currency and forced it upon everybody. Is there a government in this world, or is it just these rich people?
It's not very clear. It appears to make the Philip Weisses of the world, the bankers of the world, be in charge of things. But then they mention taxation, and there's these timekeepers who are effectively the police. And there's checkpoints in between the different districts and all of that. So it does appear that there's this governmental entity set up that is rather oppressive over people. I think what they're trying to say is that the rich people are running the show, and that they are stealing the time from the workers in the factories. And I got a clip I can throw in here where Will's talking to the timekeeper about that, because he's investigating the theft of time from when Henry Hamilton gives it to him before his death. So let me throw that in right about here.
I'm timekeeper Raymond Leon.
I'm Will Salas.
I know. Where did you get that?
A man named Henry Hamilton gave me over a century. He said he didn't need it anymore. It was a gift. I'm not a thief. But hey, if you guys are looking for stolen time, maybe you should arrest everyone here.
Oh, I see. You're talking about justice. I am a timekeeper. I don't concern myself with justice. I only concern myself with what I can measure. Seconds, minutes, hours. I keep time. And that time is in the wrong hands.
Sylvia, do as I say and go with the guards.
Oh, for God's sake, Father, there's an army in this house. If we can't stop one man from killing us, we should kill ourselves.
And scene.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the initial confrontation between Will Salas and the timekeeper. This is at the Philip Weiss's house, and the timekeeper guard people come in and attempt to arrest him. They're investigating the theft, quote-unquote, of time from the Henry Hamilton character. And Will responds to him with, well, if you're here to arrest people about stolen time, then you need to arrest everyone in this house, because it's, you know, this rich bourgeoisie aristocrat party. And he's saying that all of those people are guilty of stealing time from the masses, from the proletariat, if that's the allegory we want to bring into this.
And is that ever fully explained exactly how they're stealing? Are they the ones offering the jobs, and the proletariat are the ones voluntarily working for them?
So that's a good question. It's never really explained. It's sort of like between the lines just shown to you. It's like, just this is the present situation. In previous episode talking about this, movie, you were saying, you know, they bring up this totally far-fetched and unbelievable situation and then blame capitalism for, you know, making this such a terrible thing. So you presumably say that, yeah, they're working there voluntarily, but if they don't work every day because their day's wages are roughly 24 hours, that's why everyone only has like roughly a day to live. So they have to work every day. They get paid that same day in order to live the next day. So it's making the argument for the subsistence wage, just enough to keep them alive. That's very Marxist. Oddly, the factories themselves, this is so dumb. So the one scene where they're showing Will work in the factory, he's actually making those time bank bracelet thingies that store the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's any other factories or any other goods that are produced. I mean, there are lamps and televisions and things like that exist in this world, but they don't show them being created. They show these time things being created. And all Will does is he pulls a lever like every 5 seconds, and that's his job. Like that couldn't be fucking automated.
That he could be replaced by one of those dipping birds that just slowly tips over and taps a button and goes back up.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. So, you know, then I guess he would die, right?
So
it's pretty stupid.
There's never any showing of like food being made, or but they do buy food, right, with their time, and they use time
they buy food,
the bus or whatever.
Yeah, they pay for the bus. They pay for coffee. They complain that the coffee went up from 3 units of time to 4 units of time, and the bus, you know, fare increased by X amount. So Will's mom can't afford the bus ride, and she's like a 2-hour walk from home, and she's only got an hour and a half to live. So the bus driver tells her to run. And, you know, this is, of course, that dramatic scene where Will sees her, and they're running towards each other, and she times out like a split second before he can get to her and give her some time so she lives longer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just another bullshit scenario. I mean, okay, it's a 2-hour walk. People walk at, what, 3 to 4 miles an hour. Even if you moderately jog, you're going to make it in, you know, well under the 90 minutes. So just a bullshit scenario there. But back to the whole, you know, stealing the time, the aristocrats are stealing the time. I think that the point of what they're trying to say is that these people work in the factories, and the surplus value with the low wages, the subsistence wages, anything that is beyond that and technically belongs to the labor people is stolen and soaked up by the aristocrats. And that's, you know, a very Marxist thing. It's like saying that, you know, all the product of anything is only due to the labor that goes into it, the labor theory of value, which debunked a million times over, total bullshit. You know, you can work all day, every day on something for 30 years and never sell it. And what's your labor worth? Approximately dick in a box. And, you know, it takes tools and capital investment and entrepreneurial risk and coordination and all of these things to come together to create a product that somebody thinks will be of value to someone else, and they're willing to make a voluntary trade for it, et cetera, on and on. And that's where value comes from. You know, it's subjective. It's on the margins. It's if you think it's going to improve your situation, you're going to buy it, whatever the product or service is. And, you know, someone's going to see that there's a need, and they're going to fill it the best they can, and they're going to take that risk. And so the whole premise of these factories and the surplus value and the labor theory of value, total bullshit. I mean, this thing is commie through and through, this whole movie. And you made a comment to me last night where you were thinking that, you know, maybe Justin Timberlake didn't realize what this movie was about, but it's hard to miss it now that I've seen it again.
Well, to be fair, though, when I saw it for the first time, I was just watching it as an action movie. And we were talking, you know, when it first came out or whatever, and I wasn't necessarily privy to, you know, economic theory. But I thought it was just like an action movie. I mean, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, the world they had created. But, you know, you can just kind of gloss over that and just say, well, he's like a Robin Hood type character, and he's whatever, anti-banker.
Yeah, this movie seems to be a response to the whole, what do you call it, the...
Occupy?
Occupy. The 1%, the 99%.
Yeah.
And
it seems to be the ANCOM response to the Occupy movement.
Yeah, it's those greedy capitalist bankers who are running things, and if they are not the government, they're in control of it. And they're stealing the value that's created by labor, and they're keeping subsistence wages, and on and on. Yeah, it does seem like an ANCOM response to the financial crisis.
Yeah, sounds really good. Unfortunately, I couldn't see it again. Now, you've got Justin Timberlake. He's, what, in his late 20s? And he's pulling a lever That's his highly skilled job. That's the best he's gotten up to.
And yeah, in the movie, he's 25 plus 3, so 28 in real time.
And he's in all that time, he's never been able to do anything better.
Well, they take the world as a given. You know, they've only got so much time available in the day. They have to work in order to live to see the next day. So there's really no way to save any excess value, any excess savings to use to take on entrepreneurial risk.
But he couldn't develop skills to get a better job than pulling a lever, making himself more valuable to the owner of the factory or another prospective employer?
Well, it's not in the script, so no.
Well, I know, but it just goes to the whole bullshit nature of this movie. None of it makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, because there are a bunch of other jobs depicted in the film. There's people running the hotel. There's people at the front desk. There's people selling coffee. There's people who sell cars. There's people who work as bank tellers. There's taxi drivers. There's timekeepers. You know, there are a bunch of other jobs there. There's the guy who greets him at the casino.
Does the fact that he works in this time factory service the plot in some way? Is there some reason he was given this job? Did they have to establish that these time bands exist or something like that?
No, it's just kind of given. But it's only this district, this ghetto slum district, that has, you know, these poor people who work in this crappy factory.
Okay.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
And then what? He kidnaps the rich guy's daughter, and then she joins his side and becomes like the romantic interest, and they go on like a Robin Hood spree, robbing his banks. That's the deal.
Yeah, that's kind of it. This is a good time to throw in another clip, actually.
Help. I'll watch from here. I'll make sure you're safe.
You know, you could fight this. I can say that running to the ghetto was my idea. My father would believe that. He thinks I'm reckless. He has a lot of influence, Will. He can get you a lawyer. He can make a deal with those timekeepers.
I'm pretty sure that timekeeper doesn't make deals. Here, just in case.
Spare a second, Father. I wish I could say I'm surprised. Did you hear what I just said?
You know I would do anything for you. They're coming to get you. They know where you are.
Will, look out!
So I'm not sure you could hear that, but that's Sylvia calling her father, complaining that he didn't pay some ransom or something, and then he warns her that the timekeeper knows where they are and they're coming after him. And she has a gun that Will has given her just, you know, in case to be safe because she still has a whole bunch of time on her arm and might get robbed. And she goes, "Oh, no, Will," and points the gun at the timekeeper guy and shoots him.
What?
Was that a why?
Yes, why?
Because guns are bad.
Okay.
Yeah, no real reason. I mean, I guess the timekeeper was going to capture Will or something like that. So, you know, it brings me to this thing where they the gunplay in this is terrible. I was telling you last night. So she accidentally shoots the timekeeper is what she says later. And then they steal his police car, and they're sitting in the police car for a while. And they go, "Well, what are we going to do next?" And he's like, "I don't know. What do you want to do?" And he says, "Well, we're in a police car. Let's pull someone over." So they pull over this rich person and steal her time and her diamond earrings and, you know, pretending to be cops or whatever, which, you know, is what cops do anyway. They pretend to be cops.
Well, that is true, but so it's all of a sudden cool for them to just start robbing people?
Yeah, because they're stealing from the rich, so it's okay.
And the rich are oppressing them.
But, right. Well, right, yeah, so it's self-defense. About the gunplay, so he's talking to the chauffeur of this car, and you know, the chauffeur's like giving him some static or whatever, and so Sylvia shoots at the guy in the car, and Will's like, "What the fuck? What are you doing?" And she goes, "Oops, it just happened."
It just happened.
You know, like the gun shoots itself. The gun is like such a bad thing, and you can never know what it's gonna do. You know, it's a very lefty representation of a gun.
Yes, like a coiled snake. You just don't know. It's just gonna go off on its own.
It might come and bite you. So that's just embarrassing. And then later on, Will gives her like a shooting lesson. And, you know, he actually says, you know, don't shoot unless you're willing to kill something or whatever. You know, fingers on the triggers the whole time, even on the movie art, the poster art. You know, and she's got the gun in her hand, and she's, like, hugging him and pointing the gun, like, right at him with her finger on the trigger. You know, not intending to, like, put him in danger, but, I mean, anyone who has taken any basic gun safety course would know that's a definite no-no. So,
right.
Anyway. Hey, I want to shift this over to one of the things we were originally planning to talk about, and then we forgot to talk about because we got cut short last time, and that is how this movie depicts what would be considered a cashless society or virtual currency society. And just, we alluded to this in our Sesame credit at the end of Blazing Status, where we were saying, hey, the End Time movie is maybe version 10 of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, that gives you a rating based on how subservient to the state you are, and after a while, you know, they could maybe shut you off so that you die, you lose all these benefits and things like that. So I think that's one of the dangers of having this type of mandatory virtual currency cashless system. And there have been moves recently, talk of eliminating large denomination bills because cash is apparently this evil now that's, you know, funding the drug trade and terrorism and crime. And I saw a thing about how Edward Snowden escaped from Hong Kong to get to Moscow and how he used cash to buy things because it wouldn't leave a trace. So presumably the powers that be want to eliminate cash to make it more difficult to have any privacy in your purchases and in your behaviors. Your thoughts, Mr. Johnson?
Well, yeah, this is just the struggle for control. There's long been a push. I mean, I remember seeing books in my grandparents' house about the war on cash and the cashless society and why it's a good idea to own precious metals and sort of thing. Because you can't control a thing unless it's, you know, well, it's easier to control if it's completely digital and it's in the hands of the government and their corporate buddies. There's a huge push. Whenever they want to demonize cash or any kind of currency they don't control, they will say, yeah, it could fund terrorism. And they always use that. They catch the terms. They always say, it could fund the drug trade or terrorism. You saw that when the government, many politicians came out and demonized Bitcoin. And what they've also said, well, now large bills are used to fund drugs, which is hilarious, because if you've ever seen any of the movies concerning, like, the Iraq War, even a recent movie like that Tina Fey movie, that Tina Fey war movie, I forget the name of it, but even that will show you that there's just bundles and bundles and bundles of $100 bills that were printed up and handed out in Iraq and Afghanistan like candy to warlords for X reason or Y reason, to keep the drugs flowing, to as payoffs, as bribes to politicians, what have you. Just money was flowing freely. Probably still is, I'm sure. But what they don't want, I suppose, would be, well, yeah, so they're talking about getting rid of the 100, and then they're also talking about getting rid of, like, the smaller bills. What is safe? I don't even know from their ire. Eventually it'll all be seen as evil and able to fund drugs or terrorism or what have you. Yeah, I don't think they're going to be happy until they completely control the money supply.
Yeah, I mean, which they pretty much do as is. They control the creation of it, and you know, most funds that exist in the world are digital. They don't actually tangibly exist as cash. I think cash is something like 3%.
A small percentage of the money that's just created digitally.
Yeah.
Their banking system.
Now, in a way, I do agree that cash is bad because, you know, it's a government-issued thing. So that's bad. But the fact that it exists and it does provide some anonymity. Say that for me.
Good job.
Anonymity?
Anonymity.
Anonymous?
Just keep, you got it.
Just keep going. So it does have, you know, like a silver lining in that you can be, remain somewhat anonymous when using it. But the fact that a government or a Federal Reserve central bank issues the currency is an evil in and of itself. But to eliminate it altogether and then have a system that is a virtual currency that is controlled by those same powers is even worse, because then you lose all of the private, you know, dealings. Everything becomes transparent and visible, and, you know, affects your Sesame score or whatever.
Your Patriot points.
Yeah, your Patriot,
Patriot points.
Which is probably what it will be here, Patriot points, you know. Freedom fries.
Yeah, your freedom score, your Patriot points.
Yeah. So there's an interesting thing that, you know, this war on cash has sort of been talked about in sort of the alternative media for quite a while now, like Doug Casey's of the world and people like that. And I think it was him who brought up the idea or the whole notion that back in 1964, 65, when they demonetized the silver content in U.S. coins, so made it copper plating or whatever, that at that time, I think the largest bill was something like a $500 or $1,000 bill. And in 1965 dollars, you know, that $500 bill would buy, you know, something like $5,000 worth of goods today. And so with the inflation in the currency and the loss of purchasing power and the reduction in the denomination of what currency units are available as far as bills go, so now the largest bill is a $100 bill, it's the equivalent of, you know, like a $20 bill from back then. You know, so they've already been squeezing down the purchasing power per unit for you know, generations already.
Right. So even the $100 bill isn't really much these days, what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And now they want to eliminate that, and they want to eliminate the 20. That was the latest proposal from some asshole at Harvard. Because he's basically saying that larger bills travel easier than a whole bunch of smaller bills. So, you know, to make it more difficult to do illicit activity, there's only going to be fives and tens and ones available, so you need a frickin' wheelbarrow to buy any drugs.
How about even legal activity? I can remember half a dozen times when people have been traveling wherever to go buy whatever. So a guy will be, you could probably look this up. There are guys that say wanted to buy a car in California because, you know, sometimes people post cars for sale online. And if you're after a specific car, you got a hankering for that one specific car, and there are only a couple of them for sale in the country at any given time, you're willing to go off and get it. So a guy travels from, like, Minnesota to California, and he's got money in his trunk. Well, that's just obvious sign of illicit activity, and cop pulls him over, searches his vehicle. I'm not exactly sure how he got permission to search the guy's vehicle or had probable cause to do so, but he finds the cash and just steals it. He calls it confiscation. But if anybody else had done it, you'd be stealing it, because he says, well, it's obviously this guy's going to buy drugs, right? Because there's no other reason to be carrying cash. You couldn't just be making a private purchase with another person ever, right? And the guy even knew, the cop, like, the guy went to court to get his money back, and the cop was like, I don't see any reason why I should. I forget exactly the story, but the guy still, I don't think he's gotten his money back. And gave some bullshit excuse as to why he didn't think he should have to give it back. But, you know, what happens when the cops steal the money is they just put it in the cop slush fund. And, you know, they buy, like, smoothie machines and, like, margarita machines. And they go on vacations. And, you know, it's good times. You got stolen loot there. You got to party it up, man. Enjoy it. You're a pack of thieves. And you're got the spoils of theft. So, you know, live it up, man. Land of the free, home of the brave.
That's right. That's what they tell you. That's what they tell you. Yeah, that activity is called civil asset forfeiture, and it's a pretty big business. I don't remember the numbers on it, but it's in the billions of dollars a year. They'll take your car, they'll take anything that you've got, any cash.
And unlike human crime, I guess you could call it, the burden of proof on the property being at fault is, like, guilty until proven innocent. So there was a lady in, like, Philadelphia who they argued that since their grandson was selling drugs out of the house, regardless of whether or not, like, a customer actually came into the house or whatever, he happened to live there, and he was probably selling drugs. So they said that the house was a drug house, and they seized the house. And guess what? It's guilty until proven innocent. So you have to go to court, spend all kinds of money to try and get your house back. And it's terrible as John Oliver is. He did a decent piece on it. He's really bad. I don't recommend watching his show in general, but he did do a pretty good piece on civil asset forfeiture. There's also a law in Oklahoma now that says they can seize gift cards. If you got like gift cards in your wallet or a certain amount, because I guess people are getting their money stolen. So the market is responding by you put your money on a gift card, and so then they'll just steal the gift card. And they actually have a machine, I guess, that they carry with them now in Oklahoma, and the cops, where they can just swipe them and then steal all the money off that gift card. So there you go. That's always good.
Yeah, yeah, more terrible, terrible shit. It's ridiculous, you know, and they've demonized cash so much. Like, do you know if you deposit more than a certain amount of money in a bank, they do a report about it?
Yeah, that was, I don't know, it used to be $10,000. It might still be. But there's a famous, I don't know if you've ever watched The Sopranos, but where Carmela Soprano is depositing money in $9,900 increments in account after account to get around to that. But yeah, so they'll do that. And that, if you do that a bunch of times, that will, there's a term, it looks like you're kind of skirting the law, and so then that will pique interest, and it, they'll even steal that money from, like, normal people. There was a guy who owned a restaurant, God, you're just going off memory now, but he had all his money stolen because he basically had a cash business. He paid his employees, I don't know if he paid his employees entirely in cash, but he paid for a lot of things in cash, and all these cash deposits in his bank were seen as suspicious because they were, you know, of a certain amount or a certain frequency. And so they just stole his money. They just, like, stole his hundreds of thousands of dollars that he had saved. And don't think he's ever gotten that money back. Maybe he has, maybe he hasn't. But it's frightening when you live a place where people can just, you know, it's illegal to have money. It's just illegal to be carrying money. Like, if you were to carry a bag of cash in an airport, I mean, they'd probably just steal it.
Yeah, more terrible shit, man. It's hard to have this conversation and not get, like, you know, blood boiling.
Yeah, and I wish I had, like, the links or whatever, but you're just spurring my memory. This kind of stuff happens a lot. If you just Google civil asset forfeiture seizure, and restaurant guy or buying a car guy or Philadelphia drug house, I'm sure you'll find these links.
Yeah, they won't be hard to find. I don't think they're in the mainstream news, like front and center, you know, like your Google News feed or Yahoo News feed. But if you dig around, you'll find these stories in smaller areas, smaller outlets.
Yeah, they'll show up on like local news a lot, like your King 5 or whatever your local station is. They'll run that story, but it won't necessarily get picked up for the national syndication.
Yeah. So, I mean, in one respect, you know, I see the appeal of having a virtual currency like a Bitcoin so you can kind of avoid some of this harassment and theft.
Mm-hmm.
On the value of the Bitcoin when you bought it and when you sold it, and apparently it's not as private as people are led to believe. Like, they can actually trace it back to you. It's no longer anonymous. And government and central banks are actually investigating blockchain technology for themselves. And I think this is all part of that move towards eliminating or banning cash, because they want to get everyone on the chip in your arm, you know, like in the movie, In Time.
Yeah, although I think that there's a natural market mechanism for establishing new currencies. And new currencies can be created at any time, and they do pop up. If enough human beings reject the cashless society, we can just, print a bunch of Murray bucks or do what have you, start trading back with the tally sticks or coconuts or whatever.
Anything, yeah, no, that's a good point.
Anything that's divisible and portable, turn it into currency, man.
Yeah, you know, I'm gonna throw in a Murray bit where it talks about Mises and his book, The Theory on Money and Credit, where he talks about the origin of money and how it has to come from a market activity. So we'll just plug that in right here because it's very relevant.
So that was Mises' first great accomplishment. And his magnificent first book, Theory of Money and Credit, came out in 1912, and it's a great, still the best thing ever written on money. What he did was he healed the split, this artificial split. He applied the marginal utility theory of Austrian economics to money, integrated it. He made micro and macro one whole beautiful integrated system of economic analysis. He pointed out, for example, when you get to money, you don't use M and V. You don't forget about supply and demand. Purchasing power of money, in other words, the value of money, can be decided on the same basis as individual goods and services, namely supply and demand. An increase of the supply of money lowers its value, just as in the case of bubble gum or coffee. And an increase of demand for money raises its value, just like any other good. However, there's a big difference, and this he applies some of the Ricardian currency school insights. The big difference between money on the one hand and other goods on the other hand is that other goods are necessary to production. In other words, specific quantities. For example, if other things being equal, if you increase resources or increase the supply of goods and services, people's standard of living go up. That's a good thing, so to speak, to have more, to find new resources, to find a new oil strike, or to increase productivity. Okay. But in the field, the sphere of money is very different. The only real use of money is exchange. You don't eat money, put it bluntly. And once you have enough money to become money on the market, you don't need any more. In other words, any supply of money which is arrived at on the market is optimal. You don't need any more money coming in. So the only thing that increase the money supply does then, the only social effect, is to dilute the purchasing power of each existing, pre-existing dollar or gold ounce or mark or whatever the currency unit is. So any increase in money supply, increase in goods and services is good. It increases the standard of living. An increase in capital equipment is good. It increases future standards of living. An increase in the money supply is pointless because all it does is dilute the purchasing power of the original, of the existing unit. There's no social utility whatsoever. Now, under the gold standard, it does because the increase of gold supply has a non-monetary function. In other words, we can use more gold for jewelry, watches, teeth, and that sort of stuff. Okay. But under paper money, of course, there's no social function whatsoever. It simply dilutes the purchasing power of the dollar. And Mises goes into this, and he shows, basically, that more money, an increase in money supply beyond the amount of gold available or silver available, redistributes, destroys economic calculation, generally messes everything up, messes up the production system. What happens is a tax where the first receivers of money benefit at the expense of the late receivers. It's pretty much like counterfeiting. As a matter of fact, it is. The Fed is essentially is our legalized monopoly counterfeiter. And the effect of the Fed increasing the money supply, or the Bank of England, or any central bank, is almost the same as any counterfeiter. You have a legalized counterfeiter pouring out money down here in Anaheim, you'll have the same sort of effect. An increase in the income of people in Anaheim. First of the counterfeiters, next of the people the counterfeiters spend the money on, retailers, let's say, in Anaheim, they're in great shape. They love counterfeiting, right? And so then they begin to spend more. Prices begin to go up. Those of us who don't live in Anaheim or who have a fixed income lose. So the inflation process is essentially a counterfeiting process, except it's not people on the run from the Treasury Department. It is the Treasury. It is the Federal Reserve doing it. Okay, so Mises also built on Karl Menger's classic article on the origin of how money originates and expanded it to show the money has to originate in this way, namely out of the free market, out of the voluntary actions of goods of individuals trying to overcome the tremendous difficulties of barter. He shows that money has to originate that way. Money cannot originate as a government edict or by some social compact where everybody gets together in one big convention and says, let's make that money. It can't work that way. It has to work out of a market commodity. Unfortunately, of course, then the government can take it over and mess it up. But it has to originate as a market, valuable market commodity, such as gold or silver, which have always outcompeted all the other marketable commodities once if given a chance. You know, if people know about gold and silver, if society knows about it, they will outcompete them. Also, Mises showed in his theory of money and credit that fractional reserve banking is essentially fraudulent. It's essentially issuing fraudulent warehouse receipts to non-existent gold or cash creates this whole process, and the ideal system would be 100% reserve banking. He believed, however, and I think it's true, that under a genuine free banking system, in other words, if the banks were compelled to meet their contracts like everybody else is, forced to meet their contracts, if they say, I'm going to give you gold on demand, if you don't give it to them, you go bankrupt. If that were true, we'd have a hard money. We'd have an approach to a 100% reserve system. Unfortunately, of course, it's never worked that way, because the banks are always being bailed out one way or another. And also he showed in the theory of money and credit that that utility, he fixed up the Martian utility theory. He showed it's ordinal and can't be measured. The other, Mombavik, was a little bit weak on that. He showed that you can't, since it's subjective, you can't mathematize it. I mean, right now, micro textbooks, you look at any micro textbook, they talk about utils. They talk about utility theory. They say, well, we have utils. Some things are worth 5 utils, other things are worth 8 utils. Those are things that util. What the heck's a util? It doesn't exist. Okay. But if you assume there's such a thing as a util, then you can mathematize it and use calculus and have graphs and tangents and all that junk. It just doesn't work. It's not true. Okay. I mean, it's not junk in mathematics. It is junk, however, in economics.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And to your point, yeah, I think that you're right. I think that once they tighten their grip, even more so, and people start, you know, feeling that pinch in a visceral way, the alternatives will be discovered and will be figured out. I mean, Bitcoin was sort of one of those types of things. I mean, what's to say that people can't just start buying certain commodities to use them as trade sort of off book? You know, like rich people already do that. They buy rare pieces of art. They buy like diamonds and things like that hold a lot of value in a very small unit. And it's a way to transport that money through time or whatever however you want to do it. Not that we're giving out any advice here per se, but you know, we're just saying the market will find a way, and they'll probably deem each of those things illegal every time they crop up, you know, par for the course.
Anything they can't control is illegal and horrific and dangerous and evil.
Yeah,
I like your meme you sent me recently. I mean, talking about the drug war and how drugs are bad. And it was just like, I want to congratulate drugs in the war for winning the war on drugs.
Yeah, they certainly won that war.
Yeah, and they will continue to win
that below.
And, you know, I was just expressing my frustration. This is totally off topic. But I was just wondering the other day, you know, where all the war protesters went. You know, when Bush was president, there were all these war protesters talking about everything under the sun, and, you know, I think it was like the CIA or the FBI were infiltrating the anti-war groups and investigating them unjustly and all this sort of thing. But then once Obama gets in, they kind of just dry up, and like all of a sudden we're okay with war. It's like the bee's knees, it's totally cool. Where's the principle? Is it just who operates the war? Is that what we want? We just wanted a Democrat to operate the war, and then somehow the war is cool?
As far as I'm aware, he's doing the same shit, right?
Yeah, he's doing the same shit or increasing it. When his campaign promises were to stop it, pull all the troops home, blah, blah, blah. Another reason why you can't trust a politician, what they say. But the outrage is gone. The outrage has shifted to other things. It's like, war's fine now. Cool. I mean, if Trump gets elected, then will the war protesters come back? Talk about hypocrites. You only don't like it when a Republican's in office? Stand up for what you believe in, man. Whatever.
Yeah, that brings me to that Rolling Stone article I sent you where they gave all these reasons to not vote for Gary Johnson. You know, they say, you know, people don't really like Clinton or Trump, so it's a prime opportunity to look at a third-party candidate. But, you know, here's a list of reasons why you shouldn't do that. So if you're a Democratic-leaning person, you know, Gary Johnson says this, this, and this that you won't agree with. And then it goes through the list for conservatives, and it goes through the list if you're Libertarian-leaning or whatever. And, you know, my comment to you is you could write this about any fucking politician in any election, anywhere, at any time, because none of them are ever consistent in their principles in anything. And even beyond that, you can never believe what their campaign promises are anyway, as you just stated. You know, you just showed in a huge example of.
Yeah, they're politicians don't give a shit about principles. They are motivated by opinion polls, and they don't care about keeping their promises. They just don't give a shit. And it's always, you know, it's always the most important election. It's always this person is the best of our best hope or whatever. It's always, you know, vote for the lesser of two evils, which is a really frustrating, bad argument in my opinion. I can't blame people too much for wanting to be whipped less other than more, but even then you're going off somebody's promises or what you suspect might happen. You know, you're reading the tea leaves. You don't know what's going to happen. The chances are, no matter who gets elected, it'll be the same shit and just more of the same bad stuff. You might have a slightly different flavor to it, but it'll just be more tyranny. Maybe it'll be Coke tyranny versus Pepsi tyranny. So I'm baffled over and over and over again how people get behind, you know, any one particular candidate and say that this person is just awesome and it's going to make America right again or whatever, as if America was ever right to begin with. I guess you got to swallow that lie to even believe the new lie. But it's really frustrating from my point of view.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's every time I get up early and I send you a bunch of snippets from the Facebook, I comment over and over again, you know, the stupid never ends. It's just this endless feed.
Yeah. Yeah, dude.
But, you know, there are some bright spots out there. There's an Anarchy Ball video I shared with you that was pretty good. I think we'll save that for the SJW. And I did see a thing that's related to elections. It's a meme, and I'll post it below. I don't know if I sent this to you yet, but you'll see it. It says, it's got a Guy Fawkes mask on it, and it says, remember the 6th of November, your votes fan the embers of fascist offenders. Both lying pretenders are bailout defenders, death by drone senders, and liberty enders.
Yeah, I just sent that to you. Your memory is terrible.
You didn't send that to me. I sent it to you.
No, I sent it to you about 2 hours ago.
Oh, I got this at 8:48 a.m. That's when I downloaded it. So I saw it before you did.
8:48, huh?
That's right. That's when I saved it.
Yeah.
Either way, folks, it's going to be down below, and it's that good that we both simultaneously came to find it.
I sent that to you at 8:22.
Ah, jeez. All right, fine. I give credit where credit is due. You've given me evidence where I was incorrect.
All right.
And this is something that you will never see a politician do, by the way.
That's right.
I stand corrected.
That's right. So, Daniel, give me your review. Give me a score or something for In Time. And do you recommend people watch it?
You know, I'm glad you brought it back to In Time. There's a little bit more to the story, and then I'll give you, like, my rating, my score. So the second half of the movie, you know, the gunplay is ridiculously bad. She shoots at the guy and says, oh, it just went off, you know, mind of its own. And then they proceed to rob banks and then give out the time, like Robin Hood style. And while they're, like, fleeing the timekeepers or whatever, they get robbed, and she's rich and has, like, a decade on her arm, and they steal all of it except for, like, a half an hour. And earlier in the film, Will was very low on time and asked if he could have some from her, and she said no. But then when the roles were reversed, of course, she needs time from him, and he says, oh, so now you're into sharing. You know, so fucking terrible, you know. As if socialism and communism is all about sharing and benevolence.
Yeah, that's a myth that totally needs to be smashed.
Yeah, and I've got a good Anarchy Bell meme about that that I think I sent you, legitimately I sent you. I will send that down below. I'll put it down below.
Yeah. So once she's been established as a good communist, then she can be trusted? Or he can be?
Yeah, then...
Was it?
Yeah, then she's like, then she likes him and whatever, because, you know, he gets time and then gives it to people. Like, he actually gives the timekeeper time when she shoots the guy and he's down on the ground or whatever. Because the timekeepers work on a daily per diem, and he's been doing it for like 50 years or whatever. But they don't have unlimited time. They live day to day as well. And so Will keeps him alive, and then I think later on, you know, the guy sort of like hesitates at the end of the film in shooting Will because he's like, oh, you gave me time, so whatever. And then he realizes that his clock has run out, and then he dies. What, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But these people bullshit. Can never negotiate for a higher wage. This is really annoying.
Well, there weren't unions, my man.
So they can't just go to the, you know, their boss and say, hey, I need more money. I've been working here X amount of time. I'm worth this much. You know, I should be getting a raise or else I'm going to bounce to another job. They can't do that in this world. This is real stupid.
No, apparently there's no way to save enough time to be able to do that. But when they're doing the Robin Hood thing, they're handing out time to people and they steal enough to where everyone has like a few months or whatever. And so the rich/government just increase prices and increase taxes to compensate for it. So Will's like, oh, you know, it's all useless. It's all worthless what we did. You know, they're just raising the prices. So we're back where we started. And she says, oh, don't give up now. What would make a difference? And he's like, oh, I don't know. Like if we had 1,000,000 years of time, that would make a difference. And really? So then they proceed to rob her father to get a million years of time to hand out. And that sort of like breaks the system or whatever. But it's so fucking bullshit. Like a million years, a billion years, a billion, million, billion currency, whatever's, like the more units there are is fucking immaterial. Like it doesn't matter. You know, if the amount they were stealing from the banks and handing out wasn't working, oh, just pour it on, more of the same. That'll fix it. I mean, these guys are they're fucking central bankers, you know? They're the Keynesian Marxist morons.
Sure sounds like it. So give me a rating and give me a recommendation and who you would recommend it for.
Oh, God. All right,
yep.
So I would give this like a 5 out of 10. The
okay.
story and acting are pretty bad.
Yep.
And I would only recommend it for research purposes for people interested in flawed economic thinking and communist thought and just glaringly presented in a theatrical manner. You know, they say shit like, is it stealing if it's already stolen? Because, you know, they're stealing from the rich person and they're saying, well, she stole it first from the workers, surplus value, so, you know, we're taking it back from her. You know,
so
and
entrepreneurs
then,
don't provide value. Is that the argument?
Yeah, they're saying that capital equipment,
no risk.
Entrepreneurs, savings are meaningless. It's all the
they
labor.
They provide no value and they take no risk. Okay, so they don't deserve profit. Is that their argument?
Yeah. And then, okay. You know, in the previous episode, we played a clip where he called it Darwinian capitalism, the Philip Weiss guy. And so Justin Timberlake's character and what's her name, Sylvia, are at his vault, like, trying to break in, and they're trying to guess the code. And she says, oh, it's not my birthday. He regrets that day that I was born. Try, you know, 8481861 or whatever. I think Will says, Darwin's birthday? You know, it's like, come the fuck on. And, then, of course, that is the code to get into the vault.
Mm.
Like, they're really taking this, like, evil henchman capitalist exploiter with the, you know, he doesn't have the twirly mustache and the cane and the top hat, but he might as well. I mean, the monocle, you know? Like, you know, play the role properly there, jackass. go ahead.
So we don't have, like, believable, fleshed-out characters here. We've got caricatures of protagonist, love interest, bad guy.
Yeah, I'd say that the acting is very wooden, especially Timberlake. I think Roger Ebert, in his review, he said he liked the story a bit, but there's no character development. And I think that's pretty true.
And Timberlake hasn't really gone on to any other main leading roles. He's had like smaller parts in other movies.
I don't even know. I don't see movies anymore.
I know you don't, but I'm pretty sure I'm correct about that. I don't think he's been in many movies, but he's usually a smaller part.
Yeah,
anyway,
maybe. Oh, he reminds me of like a Keanu Reeves kind of character. You know, he's kind of the same all the time in anything, and I can't help but, you know, hear him saying dick in a box. Like this one I think I'll title In Time, you know, JT has his dick in a clock. That might be good.
Yeah, that's good.
But so they steal the million years and they give that out and it disrupts the system, right? And the factories go idle, like no one needs to work anymore. Like that's the miraculous ending.
Like all
you know,
the factories
like,
are just the time bracelet factory.
Well, they specifically show the time bracelet factory in this district that he's from, the Dayton district. But presumably it represents, you know, factories in general. Like no one needs to work
all
anymore. Yeehaw.
No more food. We don't need food anymore. We don't need beds or chairs or cars anymore. Just shut down because we all have time.
Yet somehow it ends with them about to enter this even bigger bank in some other area. So, like, even though all production is shut down and Philip Weiss, who was this big evil capitalist in charge of the government, is you know, he's broke now or whatever, somehow there's another bank to rob that's even bigger, and that's how it ends. You know, they're going to walk into this giant building, giant bank with guns in their hands to rob. And that's how it ends.
That's your wonderful protagonist, not robbing banks.
Yeah,
there is a certain amount of romanticism based on the bank robber in American cinema. I want to say that there was Johnny Depp did like a John Dillinger movie. There was a Bonnie and Clyde movie. There have been a couple of, you know, just like painting them as like Robin Hood characters when they're anything but. I mean, I've got my problems with the fractional reserve banking, how it is a breach of contract, but violently attacking to steal money is not an admirable thing. I don't think it's something that should be idolized. I mean, I understand there's this idea that bankers are the man, but I think where banking goes wrong, on top of the whole fractional reserve, is it? I'm not fully aware. Is it the government that allows the fractional reserve banking, or is it the bankers who decide that and then say that it's good? Seems like all central banks are fractional reserve and fiat currency.
So yeah, there's a whole 90-minute lecture on the origin of the Federal Reserve and the banking system and how it operates in general, and I'll post a link to that below because it's pretty badass. Like, it's more than just a clip. I mean, I might throw a clip of it here. It sort of explains like the symbiotic relationship between government and the banks to create a central banking system, like the Federal Reserve and all the other ones around the world. So I'll plug that in here.
Milton Friedman says, we assume that everybody gets a proportionate increase in the money supply dropped by some magical government helicopter. So everybody gets 30% increase in their cash. It doesn't work that way, of course. If it did work that way, there'd be no point to it. The reason why because we don't have a benevolent Angel Gabriel doubling everybody's money supply overnight to try to improve their lot. What we have is legalized counterfeiters in Washington or in London increasing their money supply first and lending it out or spending it, and then it ripples out to the rest of the society. So they're always one leg up in this expropriation process.
And then down below there will be, you know, the rest of the lecture. If anyone is interested, you know, devote the 90 minutes. And you know, a pro tip here, if you get used to hearing Murray talk, what Robert and I do, him because of bandwidth issues and me just because, you know, I'm OCD or something, I'll turn the quality down to low because I don't really care about the picture, and then I'll turn the speed up to like 1.25 or 1.5. So that means I can hear, you know, a 90-minute audio in like an hour. So that helps.
If you can retain it all, yes.
Yeah, indeed.
Absolutely. Yeah, I used to be more into the whole banking side of things, and I'll admit that I've lost a little bit of interest in it as I've gone on to, I would think, bigger questions. But the unholy marriage of the banking industry and government is absolutely an issue. Pretty horrific.
Yeah, some people get caught up in the Federal Reserve is private or whatever, but it is chartered by the government. Like, Congress has a charter, and it's been revoked in the past when it was the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States. Andrew Jackson abolished it. He paid off the national debt and all that. But, you know, it certainly is a symbiotic relationship. They feed off of each other. You know, the government gets whatever funds it needs through that system. So, you know, they're not going to turn off that hose of spigot of, you know, unlimited funds whenever they need.
No, they're not going to kill the golden goose.
Yeah, it's sort of like why Keynesianism is so popular in universities and in economics profession. It's because you're basically giving license and intellectual cover for all the political decisions made by government and politicians. So, of course, they're going to look favorably upon that and put those types of people in charge of things. You know, they're the experts, right? They're the technocrats. So they're in positions of power and influence. If they, you know, give a pro-government prescription for whatever policy is on the table.
Yeah, it's like, this is totally aside, but the idea that government creates all these problems, but then government is always prescribed as the solution, almost regardless of what the problem is. Like, for example, with the EpiPens going on right now, there's a huge issue with, the manufacturer is upping their price, and people are crying foul and saying that this is horrific. Why doesn't the FDA step in and make them force them to charge less? And so here you got a government-created problem. This basically government-granted monopoly to this one company to produce these EpiPen things and to violently force anybody else out of the market. And then, so then they can create, essentially, they have a monopoly, so they can charge whatever they want. And then people are upset about that, and they're saying, so government come in and set, like, price controls or whatever on these people, when in reality what you actually have to do is just open up the market and not attack people who are trying to make this product. And you'll have, the market of supply and demand will settle on a price that'll be much more reasonable than whatever the EpiPen manufacturer currently is charging, because there will actually be competition for those market dollars. It's really dumb. Government's constantly creating problems and then getting called upon to provide the solution to the problems that they created. And the people in the middle, the companies or whatever, I mean, I'm not saying that they're completely innocent with their dealings with the government, but you essentially have to deal with the government in order to compete in the market. So they're really, I would say, they're more reactionaries than instigators. So because they're playing by the rule set that's constantly changing. But the problem is government. And if you listen to this podcast, you hopefully understand that by now, or at least understand that that's my point. Maybe you don't.
Yeah, 19 episodes in, we might get that by now.
Hope so.
Yeah, it's like a job security thing, you know, quote unquote job, because, you know, it's not an actual job, but they'll create a problem and then it'll create, you know, three more problems that they'll have more actions to do to try to correct those previous problems and continue additional interventions. It's Mises has a really good article on this where he talks about the third way leads to, like, each intervention leads to additional interventions. So I'll post a link to that down below.
Yeah, because their initial intervention is never going to, I mean, they'll set some, so what do they do? They're going to set some market price at, like, say, $100 per EpiPen or whatever. Well, that might be feasible market-wise for the next 10 years, but who knows? I mean, they'll just end up causing, it'll end up causing more problems in the future, and so then they'll have to step back in. So they're just constantly the savior. And do they ever get the blame? I don't know. I try and blame them all the time whenever I talk, but it seems like the companies get the blame, and the government's always the savior, and it's a never-ending cycle, and all you have to do is just wait, and then there'll be some new instance, some new problem for government to solve. And so it gets instilled in the people's minds that government is the way you solve problems. And people don't look to other solutions when you've got government solving problems, supposedly. Of course, they don't. Everything they do violently, and violence doesn't solve problems. It creates more problems. So I don't know if that message is ever going to get through people's heads. I don't know. Hope so. I'm trying.
Yeah, we're certainly running against the wind, swimming upstream, and all the rest of it. I mean, it's like this overwhelming cascade of just people not understanding these very simple issues. And
they're constantly getting reinforced with, you know, that's how you solve problems. This is what you do.
Right, yeah, they go to schools and you see these things on TV. The government's always the good guy, for the most part, you know.
Yeah. There are bad actors in government. If there's ever, like, an issue with government, it's always, like, because of one bad actor. Hopefully the new Snowden movie won't play it that way, but we'll see.
Yeah, that releases pretty soon. I think we should try to see that one and do that as a timely episode, maybe as a special, because I think it's important enough to maybe that warrants as a, you know, not the every day or every Friday kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah, hopefully it'll be playing somewhat near me. That would be great. Hopefully. We'll see.
Yeah, I'll try to see it as well if I can.
Yeah,
Yeah, why don't we start to draw this one to a close? I just have one more comment on the EpiPen thing. And this is weird because a lot of left-leaning people would post to Facebook, like, even Martin Shkreli thinks that this is bad. And, you know, he's, of course, the bad guy du jour as far as a pharmaceutical person. He bought a company and they were selling a certain drug at a low price, and then he saw an opportunity because there was no competition, because the FDA didn't approve of anyone else making this thing, of jacking up the price, which is exactly what the EpiPen people did. You know, there was no competition, so, you know, charge whatever you want, whatever you can get away with, you know?
Yeah, and the commentary seems to be they'll say that, you know, they'll admit that it costs a lot of money to bring a drug to market, but they won't say outright that, you know, prices will be down lower, obviously, if these companies weren't granted monopolies to create these products, and also if the FDA, if the process to get a drug to market through the FDA wasn't something like billions of dollars.
Yeah, indeed. You know, and how many people, like, unnecessarily suffer and die due to these constraints on the market? You know, we've already seen it contributes to higher prices than they otherwise would pay. And, of course, I see a bunch of assholes out there saying, oh, you know, in Europe, they only pay like $40 for an EpiPen or whatever because of socialized medicine. Yay, socialized medicine. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really frustrating argument to hear when they talk about, yay, some socialized crap from like Cuba or some other socialized country where things are this price. Why can't it be this price here? That's really frustrating. Well, there are many factors, and they're essentially all government. But do they ever get the blame? No. Either they're funded through theft, because for whatever reason, or they have slightly less regulations than are over here. Sometimes a factor of both, but yeah, it's really frustrating.
Yes, sir. Terrible, terrible shit. Well, hey, why don't we wrap this one up? I think we beat the shit out of In Time again for the second time. It's part two of the JT's Dick in the Clock. And
Lonely Island.
Yeah, word him up, word him up.
Hey, Lonely Island time back in the SNL was still pretty good. I got to say, I was actually watching SNL during that time, and they had some pretty funny skits. Lazy Sunday, Dick in the Box, Mother Lover, some good stuff.
I did like the one where they say happy birthday to the ground and throw the cake on the ground.
Yep, that's a good one. I'm not a part of your system. I'm an adult. Happy birthday to the ground.
Yeah, I'll see if I can dredge up some of that stuff and post it below. Or you know, you people know how to operate the internet. Find it your fucking self, right?
Right.
Yeah, find it yourselves, folks. And, hey, find your way to readrothbard.com. We've got so much stuff there. It's more and more all the time. We keep adding podcasts. There's lectures. There's books. There's articles. There's merch you can buy. All sorts of good stuff. So check us out, readrothbard.com.
Check us out. What do you want to do next time, Daniel?
Well, if we can, let's try to do the Snowden thing. I'll see if I can get my butt in the seat and watch that.
Is that coming up soon?
I think tomorrow or Friday. I think Friday.
Oh, snap. Oh, snaps. Okay. Yeah. All right. We'll try and do that. That'll be exciting.
Yeah. And this episode won't post until the following Friday, so it's going to be a little time shift on you folks, you know, since we're on the time.
But maybe our Snowden episode might beat this one to market.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. It might. Hopefully it will.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us. And we've been the Read Rothbard podcast. We appreciate your time. So, Robert, go ahead and say good night.
Good night, Robert. Take care of yourself. I like you. Bye.
Oh, you're a funny one. All right, bye-bye. All right, it's still recording because I can't find the thing to turn it off. Where are you? Show off.
This is a professional podcast.
Oh my goodness. All right, I found it. I'll cut this shit out. Don't worry.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.